I am. After so many years, hounded by hatred and trapped by fear, I'm in a box. I've got no place to go. If I follow my mind, I know I slaughter my own. Help me, I'm the prisoner. Won't you hear my plea? I need somebody, yeah, to listen to me. I beg you, brothers and sisters, I'm counting on you, yeah.
That's poet, author, musician, and spoken word performer Gil Scott-Heron with The Prisoner. It's from his 1971 album, Pieces of a Man. The Revolution Will Not Be Televised was one of his best-known works. Gil Scott-Heron died on May the 27th, 2011, at the age of 62. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. The United States leads the world in incarceration. 2.4 million people are in its prisons, jails, and detention centers, and an additional 5 million are under state or federal supervision through probation or parole. The United States accounts for only 5% of the world's population, but is responsible for nearly 22% of the world's prison population, says Amnesty International. In fact, according to the Sentencing Project, the prison population has grown 500% in the past 30 years. Our guest, Carl Dix, has been working to stop mass incarceration since the mid-1990s, and in 2011 played a key role in starting the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He's a national spokesperson for the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, also known as the RCP. And thanks, Carl, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on, Utrice.
Thank you. There are those who would say there's a perfectly logical reason for these staggering numbers. There's a lot of crime, therefore there are lots of people committing those crimes, therefore there are lots of people who should be in prisons and jails. What's wrong with this line of reasoning?
Well, the first thing that's wrong with it is that it is not correct, because when you look at the development of incarceration in this country and the way it has gone over the past 45 years, there has been an 800% increase in the number of people in prison. Because back in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, there were less than 300,000. Today, there are more than 2.3 million. It is not the case that crime has leaped eight times. What has leaped is the criminalization, especially of black and brown people. Because you track over that period, you have the wars on drugs, which were really wars on people, certain kinds of people that the system and the authorities hated and feared, especially black people and brown people. You have laws passed like the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between cocaine in its crack and powder version. By that I mean 5 grams of crack cocaine would get you the same penalty as 500 grams of powder cocaine. Now, scientists who checked these things knew at the time there was no difference between the two kinds of cocaine scientifically in terms of their addictive capability, any damage they would do to people. But the one difference was who used them. And the people who used crack cocaine were black and Latino people in the inner cities of the U.S. The people that used powder cocaine were better off people, more likely to be white. So what was criminalized in that case was the people using that form of cocaine, not the cocaine itself. And there were steps like that that led to and fed into this huge increase, not skyrocketing crime rates or anything like that.
You've been involved in this effort. What brought you to this particular effort of wanting to stop or seeking to stop mass incarceration?
Well, it's a part of looking at the role that the criminal justice system, which I have to call the criminal injustice system in this country, plays in suppressing different sections of people and in playing the role of almost a counterinsurgency before the insurgency can begin. Because I made the point about the targeting of blacks and Latinos in terms of some of the laws that are passed, but also the way that they are enforced. And we have to step back and say, well, why is that? And the answer is that the authorities remember the role that black people, especially young black people, played in the 1960s, when they stood up against the oppression coming down on them and spearheaded a broader resistance movement and even the development of a revolutionary movement that knocked the system back on its heels. They are determined to not allow that to happen again. And you can even trace this to a Nixon administration cabinet meeting. Nixon is the Republican president who got elected in the late 60s, reelected in the early 70s, and then run out of office because of Watergate. But at a cabinet meeting, he said, and this is attested to by other members of his cabinet, the problem is the blacks, and we have to devise a solution that doesn't acknowledge that that's what we're dealing with.
Is this recognition more widespread than Nixon, that this is we lost him there for a minute, but we'll get him back. These things happen. He's obviously in the field, but we'll be getting him back very shortly. This is a major problem. It has not really taken center stage as such, but just from the figures that I've been quoting to you, from these various sources authenticating them, we're talking in any given year, this year alone, let's say, we're talking about a population that is more than the population of many, many countries. Carl, you're back, so that's good.
Yes, I am.
This view that you talked about by Nixon, how has that entrenched itself not only within the system of governance, but also within the social mindset, the popular mindset? Do we really have a racial, a kind of racial segregation here as it applies to incarceration?
Yeah, we really do. And it's important that you brought in that connection between what's being done by the authorities, but also how it impacts the popular understanding, because far too many people have bought hook, line, and sinker the justifications that the authorities give for this. Because in the 1970s, when Nixon launched the first war on crime and war on drugs, there was all kinds of government propaganda about the scourge of crime and drugs, especially in the inner city and black communities. Then you see it being repeated with the crack epidemic, where they're talking about crack like it's the worst drug that's ever been conceived, and targeting it for law enforcement while ignoring its powder version, which was also being widely used. And then you even have it today where you have a city like New York City where the government will tell you that people use marijuana in relation to their percentages in the population. But when it comes down to who gets arrested for marijuana use, there are 50,000 people in jail in New York City for marijuana possession. 45,000 of them, 90%, are either black or Latino. And that's in a state where it is not illegal to possess small amounts of marijuana, to have that on your person, as long as you don't display it in public. But the NYPD has gotten very adept at getting those small amounts of marijuana to be displayed in public if you happen to be black or Latino through their employment of stop and frisk. And people accept that as, well, it must reflect the criminal activity of the people who end up in jail, not that these people have been criminalized. And that's something that I have set out to try to, you know, break people from swallowing those justifications. That's something that we did when Cornel West and I joined up for the campaign to stop, stop and frisk back in 2011. And it's something that we've carried forward into Rise Up October, the mobilization for a massive march here in New York City on October 24th to stop police terror. Which side are you on?
We come to the inevitable question here. What degree of responsibility lies within a community itself, knowing that it is being targeted, and yet, for lack of a better term, providing in a way the basis for attack? That is to say, the use and possession of drugs. We know, because it has been documented, that even the drug plague was in fact encouraged by government itself. So we have several layers of being targeted. What is being done to translate, just as you explained it here, in a very clear way, to raise a consciousness of people that this too is part of the self-destruction, that don't need to participate in it?
Okay. Well, what we do in relation to that is that we go into the communities that are being targeted by the police, by law enforcement, by the courts, the communities where people are put on a track of going into and out of prison from very early on in school. And we say to people, like, look, you are being played. You're being beaten down and oppressed by the system, who then makes available to you a system that's stripped away legitimate means to survive, and then makes available to you means that are considered illegitimate, and then arrests you and criminalizes you for being in the proximity of those means. And we say to people, we understand why you're pulled into it, but look, you got to get out of that, and you got to get into something that's about ending all of the oppression that comes down on you and ending oppression overall. That's the revolutionary approach that we take. And then we also take an approach of saying, here are beginning steps that we can take. We don't have to accept what they do to us. And we challenge people to stand up and to resist it, to not view it like, well, the problem is the young people who get caught up in the drugs and crime. So you call on the state through its police to come in and crack down on them. Because when you do that, what you get is a police clampdown on the whole community. Because stop and frisk did not and does not target crime and criminal activity. It targets whole categories of people. It criminalizes the people. And we're doing that through Rise Up October, saying to people, like, look, these murders that police get away are a concentration of an overall program of suppression, one that frankly has genocidal implications, and we don't have to keep accepting it. We can stand up, we can resist it, and that when we do that, we can win other people to come to our side. Then at the same time, we go throughout society and we challenge people to not sit on the sidelines, to not buy the justifications that the authorities are bringing out to them, and to look at the reality. And then we try to put that reality before society as broadly as possible. That's one reason why, in relation to this October 24th march in New York City, we are going to bring 100 family members of people killed by police to New York City to give them a platform to talk about the devastation that the murders of their loved ones have had on them and their communities. And through that, we're going to put a human face on these killings by police to counter the way that when police kill someone, then that person gets killed a second time when their reputation gets dragged through the mud by the news media and the authorities condemning them in order to justify the murder that the police carried out. I mean, and we can see that in a killing that recently happened by police in the area of Ferguson, where they shot a teenager named Mansour Balbi. And the initial story was that Mr. Balbi, a teenager, a black teenager, was a drug dealer who engaged in the shootout with police. But there were witnesses, and the witnesses pointed out Mr. Balbi was not a drug dealer. He was in the vicinity of a house that the police raided, and he ran when he saw these white guys breaking into this apartment. He may have known they were the police and feared for his life, or he may have figured, this is a robbery, let's get out of here. Then the other thing that undercuts their story is that Mr. Balbi was shot in the back. And then when the police tried to produce the gun, they couldn't produce it, and they went back to the neighborhood the next day and miraculously found the gun that they claimed Mr. Balbi displayed. But it all reeks of a police concoction of doctored evidence in order to criminalize after the fact someone that they had already murdered. We have to bring this reality out to people, and a very important part of doing that is to give the loved ones of those whose lives have been stolen a platform where they can talk about who these people were.
Could you talk about how you're shaping up the organization of the October 24th event and how people can basically get more information and become involved?
Okay. The way to get more information and get involved is to go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's Stop Mass Incarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .net, and you can find out about the meetings that we're having. Cornel West and I are the featured speakers at a program tomorrow night, August 27th, at the First Corinthians Church in Harlem at 6:30. We encourage people to come out to that. You can find out about that. And you can also, if you want to go old school, you can call our phone number, which is area code 646-709-1961. That's 646-709-1961. And we really encourage people to get involved because we have organization around this developing all across the country, and we can plug people in if organizations already started in their city. We're also developing borough captains in New York City so that we have people responsible for organizing each borough, because we want to bring thousands upon thousands of people to New York City on the 24th of October. But we also want to have thousands upon thousands of people in New York City in the streets with them. and all together saying, stop police terror, which side are you on?
I want to thank you for giving us this heads up. We will be exploring this in greater detail as things develop. But I want to invite you back, Carl, for a more extended conversation on this because it is of such urgent need to be understood. The impact is huge, and it falls to the community most impacted to begin the process of organizing against it. So thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you for having me on, and, you know, give me a call. I'll come back on.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Michelle Alexander, Associate Professor of Law at Ohio State University, talking about the policies that produce mass incarceration right after this break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we are staying with the topic of mass incarceration. This time, we are about to hear a presentation. This was given in 2013, but very, very up to date, in my view, because it deals with the systemic beginnings of this mass incarceration. It is a talk by Michelle Alexander. She is speaking at the University of Tennessee on the occasion of the commemoration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Here she talks about how this incarceration, mass incarceration, developed and what we need to understand about it. The enormity of the problem, the impact of the problem, the pervasiveness of the problem, and, of course, the racial links to the problem. She's the author of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, Michelle Alexander.
It has been said by numerous philosophers and theologians that any society, any civilization, must be judged by how it treats its most vulnerable members and its prisoners. King would no doubt agree with that assessment. And in considering how we fare in that regard, I find myself thinking of people like Susan Burton, people who have cycled in and out of our nation's prison system in this era of mass incarceration, in this post-King, post-civil rights era, a time when our prison population has more than quintupled and millions of people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, have been permanently locked up or locked out, stripped of the very civil and human rights Dr. King and so many others risked their lives for and some even died for. I think of Susan, whose son was killed by the police. A police cruiser barreling down her street in Los Angeles ran over her 5-year-old boy. She received no apology, no real acknowledgement of her loss, and she fell into a deep, deep depression, racked with grief, and she ultimately became addicted to crack cocaine. Now, if Susan had been wealthy, if she had even been solidly middle class with a good job and a good health care plan, she undoubtedly would have qualified for many, many hours of therapy and counseling. She likely would have qualified for very good legal prescription drugs that would help her cope with her severe depression and grief. But no, things were different for Susan. Impoverished, living in LA, she became addicted to crack cocaine and thus began her odyssey of cycling in and out of prison for 15 years. 15 years. Every time, prosecutors said, just take the deal. We'll give you 3 years rather than 8. This time we'll give you 5 years rather than 12. This time we'll cut you a break. Just take the deal. We'll give you 2 years rather than 6. One plea deal after another. Never offered drug treatment, only shown to a prison cell. Every time she was released, pushed out onto the streets, unable to find work, no housing, often sleeping on the streets, cycling in and out of our prison system for 15 years until, by no small miracle, she was granted access to a private drug treatment facility. She got clean and was given a job. She decided that she was going to dedicate the rest of her life to ensuring that no other woman would have to go through what she went through. And she began by going down to Skid Row in Los Angeles and meeting women, prisoners, as they would get off the prison bus on Skid Row. Get off the bus carrying nothing but a cardboard box carrying their belongings, little or no money, turned out on the street. And she would say to these women who were strangers to her, just come home with me. You can sleep on my couch. You can sleep on my floor. You don't have to turn to the streets. I'll take care of you. I'll give you food. I'll give you a safe place. Just come home with me. Susan Burton now runs 5 safe homes for women in Los Angeles, women released from prison. Her organization is called A New Way of Life. She prides help finding jobs, housing, helps to reunite women with their families. And beyond that, she is organizing formerly incarcerated people to demand the restoration of their basic civil and human rights. Clearly, Susan has caught up to King. But what about the rest of us? Now, what I have to say on this point will not be popular. It is not the sunny, cheerful message that is expected on the day after we inaugurated for the second time our nation's first black president. But I believe it to be the truth, and it implicates me, and it implicates everyone in this room. And the truth is this: we have allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. In the years since Dr. King's death, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged from the ashes of slavery and Jim Crow. A system of mass incarceration that no doubt has Dr. King turning in his grave today. The mass incarceration of poor people of color in the United States is tantamount to a new caste-like system, one that shuttles our young people from decrepit, underfunded schools to brand new high-tech prisons. It is a system that locks poor people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, into a permanent second-class status nearly as effectively as earlier systems of racial and social control once did. It is, in my view, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I am always eager to admit that there was a time when I rejected this kind of talk out of hand. There was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow, believing that those kinds of claims and comparisons were exaggerations, were distortions, were hyperbole. In fact, there was a time when I thought that people who made those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But what a difference a decade makes. For after years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality, and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color, and attempting to assist people who have been released from prison re-enter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is just so obvious to me now, that what seems odd in retrospect is that I could have been blind to it for so long. As I write in the introduction to my book, The New Jim Crow, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of color blindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices that we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America, we have merely redesigned it. Now, for those who might think that's overstating the case, consider this. There are more African American adults under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, explicitly denying the right to vote on the basis of race. The 15th Amendment prohibited all laws that explicitly denied the right to vote on the basis of race. But during the Jim Crow era, poll taxes and literacy tests circumvented the 15th Amendment and operated to deny African Americans a chance to vote. Well, today, in many states, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplish what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. Now, this doesn't affect just some small segment of the African American community. To the contrary, in many large urban areas today, more than half of working age African American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in some cities, like Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, DC, the list could go on. In some cities, the statistics are far worse. In fact, it was reported in Chicago that if you take into account prisoners, if you actually count prisoners as people, and keep in mind that prisoners are excluded from poverty statistics and unemployment data, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working age African American men criminal records are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find today that when I tell people that I now believe that mass incarceration is like a new Jim Crow, a new caste-like system, people react with this complete disbelief. They just say, how can you say that? How can you say that? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would just stop running around committing so many crimes, we wouldn't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of their civil and human rights. Well, therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's just not true. Our prison population quintupled in the space of 30 years. Quintupled. We have gone from a prison population of about 300,000 to an incarcerated population now of over 2 million. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of even highly repressive regimes like Russia or China or Iran. But again, this can't be explained simply by crime or crime rates. No. No. During that same period of time that our incarceration rates increased exponentially, crime rates fluctuated. Went up, went down, went back up again, went down again. And today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, nationally, crime rates are at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime is going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what explains this sudden explosion in incarceration, the birth of a penal system unprecedented in world history, if not crime and crime rates? Well, the answer is the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement. The wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about two-thirds of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of the greatest expansion of our prison system. To get a sense of how large a contribution the war on drugs has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in some form in their lifetime. Most do. But the enemy in this war has been racially defined. Not by accident. This drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color do not use or sell illegal drugs at higher rates than whites, or sell. Now that defies our basic racial stereotypes about who a drug dealer is. Picture in your mind a drug dealer, and who do you see? There's actually been studies conducted asking that particular question. In the mid-1990s, a national survey was conducted asking people to close their eyes and imagine a drug criminal and report what they saw. Over 95% of respondents pictured someone African American. Only 5% pictured someone of any other racial or ethnic group. So when we think of drug criminals in the United States, typically think of people who are black and brown. But studies have consistently shown that people of all races use and sell drugs at remarkably similar rates. And in fact, where significant differences in the data can be found, some studies suggest that white youth are more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. But that's not what you would guess by taking a peek inside our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, I know that many people who see this data say, oh, yeah, that's a shame. That's a shame, but, you know, we need to get tough on them, those folks. In the hood, because that's where the violent offenders can be found. That's where the drug kingpins can be found. What maybe people don't realize, though, is that this drug war has never been aimed primarily at rooting out the violent offenders or the drug kingpins. No. Federal funding has flowed in this war to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. Law enforcement agencies have been rewarded in cash for the sheer numbers of people swept into the system for drug offenses. which helps to explain why so many police officers go out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching, tossing as many people as possible in an effort to get their numbers up. And to make matters worse, federal drug forfeiture laws allow state and local law enforcement agencies to keep for their own use up to 80% of the cash, cars, homes seized from suspected drug offenders. You don't have to be convicted, just suspected of a drug offense. Law enforcement could take your cash, seize your car, thus granting to law enforcement a direct monetary interest, not in ending drug abuse or drug addiction or drug-related crime, but in the longevity of this war itself. And the results have been predictable. People of color have been arrested en masse for primarily non-violent drug offenses. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 were sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or even significant selling activity. And in the 1990s, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug that's been shown to be less harmful, or at least less addictive, than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this war almost exclusively in the hood, we've managed to create this vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. Now, where has the U.S. Supreme Court been in all of this? Where has the U.S. Supreme Court been? Well, far from protecting the interests of discrete and insular minorities, far from doing that, the U.S. Supreme Court has been busy defending this war at every turn. The U.S. Supreme Court, over the last couple of decades, has eviscerated Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, granting to the police the authority to stop, frisk, search just about anyone, anywhere, without any probable cause or reasonable suspicion, not a shred of evidence of criminal activity, as long as they get consent. Now, what's consent? Consent is when a police officer walks up to a young man. Officer walks up to a young man with one hand on his gun and says, "Son, put your arms up in the air so I can search you, see if you got anything on you." Kid says, "Uh-huh." That young man just waived his Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. Law enforcement doesn't have to have a shred of evidence to support that frisk now that the young man has consented, of course, believing that he really had no ability to refuse consent and walk away. Now, you might say, well, these are just isolated instances, but the reality is these isolated incidents add up to enormous racial disparities. The New York Police Department reported that in 1 year alone, just 1 year alone, it stopped and frisked more than 600,000 people. 1 year alone, overwhelmingly black and brown men. But the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that we cannot challenge these racial disparities in a court of law. In a series of cases beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp and Armstrong versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled explicitly that it doesn't matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence might be. It does not matter how severe the racial disparities are. Unless you can offer proof of conscious intentional bias, tantamount to an admission by a police officer or a law enforcement official, you can't even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system today. So many of the racial profiling cases that I was litigating 10 years ago can't even be filed today. The U.S. Supreme Court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. In so many ways, the U.S. Supreme Court has effectively immunized this system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias, much in the same way that the U.S. Supreme Court once rallied to the defense of slavery and rallied again to the defense of Jim Crow in earlier eras. But of course, just being swept into the system with little hope of being able to challenge the bias or tactics that got you there is just the beginning for so many. Because once you've been swept in and branded a criminal or felon, you're then ushered into a parallel social universe in which the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement no longer apply to you. You may be denied the right to vote for a period of years or the rest of your life, depending on the state you live in. You're deemed ineligible for jury service for the rest of your life if you've been branded a felon. For the rest of your life, discrimination in employment will not only be legal, but absolutely routine. You'll be forced to check that box on employment applications asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it doesn't matter if that felony happened a few weeks ago, a few months ago, or 45 years ago. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box, knowing full well your application's going straight to the trash. Many people will say to me, oh, come on, stop making excuses for people. Yeah, you know, when you get out of prisons, it's hard, it's tough, but if you try hard, I mean, if you really work at it, put yourself out there some, you know, you can get a job. I mean, you could get a job at McDonald's or Burger King or something. Getting a job at McDonald's is no easy feat if you have a felony record. Housing discrimination, perfectly legal and absolutely routine. Release from prison, public housing projects, as well as private landlords free to discriminate against you, close their doors. Discrimination in public benefits, legal and routine. In fact, under federal law, you are deemed ineligible even for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. Now, fortunately, many states have now opted out of the federal ban on food stamps for drug offenders. But it's still the case that hundreds, thousands of people can't even get food stamps to feed themselves because they were once caught with drugs. Now, what are people released from prison expected to do? You're tossed out on the curb. Can't get a job. Can't get housing. Even food stamps might be off limits to you. What do you expect it to do? Well, apparently what we expect people to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support, which continues to accrue while you're in prison. And in a growing number of states, you're then expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And paying back all these fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support may well be a condition of your probation or parole. And then get this. If you're one of the lucky few, the very few, who actually manages to get a job right out of prison, up to 100% of your wages could be garnished. 100%. To pay back.